This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Apple wades further into the TV business, the government takes a closer look at home buyers, and we get ready for Brexit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, the 25th of March. Thanks for joining us. Despite the fact that I'm in Washington, we're going to leave the news about the special counsel's investigation to the political shows and go somewhere else today. Specifically, Cupertino, California, where today Apple hosted one of its special events at their headquarters in Silicon Valley. Usually these things are for the splashy rollout of new products, the latest iPhone or Mac, unveiled on the black stage with dramatic music and slick videos. You had all of that today, too, but Apple wasn't launching new devices. The company announced a whole new suite of services, a new credit card that works with Apple Pay, a long-anticipated streaming TV service, plus a bunch of original content. Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports on how Apple plans to compete in the already crowded streaming business.
One way to compete? Trot out the big names. Apple announced a slate of original shows and movies with Steve Carell, M. Night Shyamalan, Steven Spielberg, and Octavia Spencer and Reese Witherspoon.
I create the dimensions of who this woman is.
Imagine if you were this person, and imagine if you lived in that world.
Apple's spending over $1 billion on new content. But media analyst Michael Goodman at Strategy Analytics says the company's got its work cut out for it.
That $1 billion is getting them in total about 30 shows. That's nothing compared to what you see in terms of original content on Netflix and Amazon and everybody else.
Customers can add HBO, Showtime, and other channels by paying extra. Hulu already does that, but Apple feels it has an advantage.
And you can play all of it right inside the Apple TV app.
Peter Stern, Apple's VP of Services, repeated a theme of the company's presentation.
No more bouncing from app to app.
He's marketing Apple TV Plus as a one-stop shop that's an antidote to streaming fatigue. A recent survey from consulting firm Deloitte found about half of U.S. consumers are getting tired of too many streaming options. Jeff Laux conducted the survey.
I've even talked to one person who said that she uses a spreadsheet to figure out which shows she can watch on which service.
Apple's been relying more and more on services to generate revenue. The company brought in $10 billion through services in the last quarter of last year, and over the next 4 years, the company wants to double that number. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Some changes are coming in the housing industry. Earlier this month, the FHA, Federal Housing Administration, told lenders it will start flagging more loans as high risk, creating additional steps for some borrowers seeking FHA-insured loans. It's a bit of a reversal for the agency. About 3 years ago, the FHA actually loosened its standards for home loans. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
In 2016, the FHA made it easier for people with low credit scores and higher debt to get a mortgage. And since then, the agency has seen more of those borrowers taking out home loans. FHA Chief Risk Officer Keith Becker says there's been a downside to that.
It seems to be concentrating our credit risk in the lower credit portion of the mortgage market. But at some point, that will begin to result in higher incidences of default and higher claims being paid.
And Becker says when the FHA has to step in for a homeowner who can't pay, the agency's reserves dwindle. The FHA says its new higher standards will apply to 40 to 50,000 loans every year. Michelle Dickerson is a law professor at UT Austin who specializes in housing issues.
So the premise is a very good one. I mean, you should never approve loans for people that can't afford to actually repay the loan.
But it means that some prospective first-time buyers could be shut out of the housing market. And if you're a borrower looking for an FHA-backed loan, you're going to have to go through a longer, more cumbersome application to prove you can afford to pay. Edward Pinto with the American Enterprise Institute says that's not necessarily a bad thing.
The people who end up maybe not getting the house because they don't qualify may actually, FHA may be doing them a favor.
Because, he says, it'll save them from ruinous debt. In a statement, Quicken Loans, one of the biggest FHA lenders, says it doesn't expect tougher FHA standards to significantly affect its business. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've been listening to this show, or the president, you'll know we are experiencing the lowest unemployment we've seen in decades. That's good for workers looking for a job, but pretty tough for companies trying to hire. We are in the midst of one of the worst labor shortages in American history, and the workers most in demand might surprise you. Alexia Fernandez-Campbell wrote about this for Vox, and she joins me in our D.C. studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
In your article, you write about there being a million more jobs available than workers actually looking for a job. Can you put that number into some context?
Yeah. So if you just compare that to the height of the recession, there were about 15 million people looking for work and only about 3 million jobs available. So this is a huge shift. And ever since the government has started tracking this 20 years ago, there's never been a point in time where there are more jobs available than workers. So that's kind of what's happening right now.
So the classic image of these in-demand workers, somebody with leverage to negotiate a better job for themselves, is like an engineer or maybe a high-skilled tech worker. But you're painting a different picture in your piece.
Yeah, right now for the first time, I mean, there's still a shortage in STEM jobs, but right now, for the first time, it's harder for companies to fill low-skilled positions. Restaurant servers, hotel workers, home healthcare aides, there's no better time for them to start saying, hey, we want a raise, we want paid time off, we want sick days, we want vacation. That's who has the leverage right now, not necessarily like the Google engineer.
And what does that mean for those companies looking to fill those positions?
That means that they're really going to have to make their jobs a lot more appealing if they expect to keep hiring, because right now those jobs at the fast food industry are not the best jobs. So if you want someone to like decide, hey, you know what, I want to work there, you're going to have to make it a lot better for them.
Does that translate into higher wages? Because we haven't really seen wage growth moving up at the rate that we might expect in this economy.
Yeah. So one thing economists are saying is that the wage growth has been really slow and that employers are now starting to realize that this is the only way to fill those positions. So we've actually seen an increase. It's not as fast as everyone would like, but it also means that there are people that would probably be more willing to join the workforce who are marginally attached to the workforce that haven't yet. So I'm thinking that that trend will probably change.
So the businesses that are struggling to find people to fill their jobs and their open positions, what happens if this trend continues, if that gap continues to widen? What does that mean for those businesses?
I mean, if they can't fill positions, I mean, that's going to affect their bottom line. The reason they're hiring is because they have enough money and they're doing well enough and they want to keep growing so that they can keep making more money. So it means that not only are their businesses not going to be able to grow as fast, that's going to slow down the economy. And we're already starting to see signs of that the economy is slowing down a bit. It's not necessarily a terrible thing. I mean, it's good for workers. It's just, it's right now, you know, when you hear in real estate, like it's a buyer's market or a seller's market, right now it's a worker's market, not, you know, an employer's market. So they're not happy about it. But the problem is that if they can't fill it, it's going to impact the economy.
Alexia Fernandez-Campbell covers policy and politics for Vox. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
In It's been almost 3 years since the UK voted to leave the European Union. The deadline for that, for Brexit, could be as soon as April 12th. To explore how what's happening over there matters to us over here, Kai Rizdal and the Marketplace team are spending a few days in London and in the countryside, hearing from regular Brits and key decision makers. We'll hear more from Kai about what he found later in the week. You can also follow along with our team on Instagram, which is at Marketplace APM. But for now, a small taste. For one man, the possibility of the UK breaking away from Europe and isolating itself brought to mind a quintessentially British dairy product and the story of its near extinction many times over. That man is an author who goes by John Bull online. He tweeted a pretty extensive thread about it, and we put it to music. Here he is.
Tweet one. Let's talk about a subject very dear to me. Cheese. Specifically, how the last period of isolation from Europe and enforced austerity almost destroyed the glorious cheeses of the north of England forever. Let's talk about Wensleydale. Yorkshire Dales, located in the northern part of England, produce some of the finest cheeses in the world. They're a product of love, local cheesemaking knowledge, and, of course, the British weather. Foremost among them, to my mind, is a good Yorkshire Wensleydale. If you're not familiar with Dales cheeses, they're white, rich, and... well, look, just go eat some, OK? Or read this official government definition. The cheese is a creamy white colour with an open, crumbly, textured appearance. The outside of cheese is more yellow. This inconsistency is the hallmark of a truly handmade product, particularly in the cloth-bound cheeses. Find someone who looks at you the way the author of this definition looks at Wensleydale cheese. Tweet 4. Wensleydale has been made in the Dales since the 12th century, when a bunch of French monks rocked up with the recipe. Indeed, the cheese's first crisis came when Henry VIII, God's own Brexiteer, dissolved the monasteries. Luckily, when the monks left, the farmers made it themselves. Or, more specifically, the farmers' wives. They made it, improved it, defined it, and ensured that glorious, glorious British cheese thrived. Anyway, jump forward. Now we're in the late 1930s. Wensleydale has just survived another brush with death, thanks in no small part to Kit Calvert.
Yorit!
A local man who helped save the Wensleydale Creamery and became known as the King of Wensleydale. He fought tooth and nail to keep it being made locally throughout the Great Depression.
Tooth and nail!
Then World War II happens. World War II brings with it isolation, Battle of the Atlantic, rationing. The Ministry of Food allows only four types of cheese to be made. Cheddar, Cheshire, Leicester and Dunlop. No Dales cheeses. No Wensleydale. Facing the death of Dales cheeses, the Wensleydale Cheese Joint Conference meet with the ministry. How can I get on the ration books, they ask. Change Wensleydale, they're told. Make it less moist. Make it more generic. They reluctantly agree. Austerity Wensleydale is born. Seriously, I've tried it. It's freaking awful. It was a devil's pact, but the only way to survive. Four acceptable cheeses became five. Wensleydale was added to the list. But it came at enormous cost. The smaller farms just stopped making proper Dales cheese. Tweet 13. On to the mid-1950s. The Milk Marketing Board want to bring back all the cool cheeses. Remember Kit Calvert, the King of Wensleydale? They ask him to bring back Dale's cheeses. With a heavy heart, he tells them,
"Real Wensleydale cheese died in the early 1940s.
Kit had been to all 176 pre-war Dale's cheesemakers. Austerity Wensleydale had broken them.
There was all hell let loose in the Dale, and eventually they just chucked it, one after another.
The old ways of making Wensleydale and small cheeses in general were either forgotten, or those who knew them refused to return to cheesemaking. And this is Wensleydale's tragic secret, one shared by other great British cheeses. The cheeses we have now are often a result of extraordinary cheese archaeology. They're often because creameries and independent farmers have fought to rebuild lost cheesecraft. Tweet 17. Modern Yorkshire Wensleydale is amazing and unique. But it was birthed through decades of painful efforts to rediscover a lost art. So what's the point of this thread? Anyone who thinks cheese isn't relevant to Brexit needs to think again. Just as those French monks introduced Wensleydale back in the 12th century, we don't know what people in a few centuries will also think of as a no-brainer, brilliant, British, or even Yorkshire cheese. Want my guess? Yorkshire squeaky cheese. It was created by a Syrian refugee who ended up in Yorkshire. Trust me, it's amazing. So remember, British cheese is awesome, and it is more complex than you think.
That was John Bull reading a Twitter thread he wrote about Wensleydale cheese. You can find him on Twitter at Garius. And you can follow Kai and Marketplace's Brexit reporting on Instagram and read all our coverage at marketplace.org. By the way, we've got some photos of that cheese, just in case you're curious. Coming up,
if it goes 2 years this way, then I have to work another 4 or 5 years to get back where I'm at today.
What's going on with America's farmers? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 14 points, less than 0.1%, to close at 25,516. The Nasdaq dipped 5 points, just under 0.1%, to finish at 76.37. The S&P shed 2 points, almost 0.1%, to end at 27.98. As we reported, Apple made a big splash today by announcing new ventures in TV, news, gaming, and financial services. Apple's newly unveiled credit card will be connected to Apple Wallet. It's a joint venture with Goldman Sachs and MasterCard. Apple shares were down 1.2%. Goldman shares dropped 0.2%. MasterCard shares lost 0.1%. And remember Stormy Daniels? Yeah. Well, in a bizarre development, her attorney, Michael Avenatti, was arrested today for allegedly attempting to extort more than $20 million from Nike over a supposed college basketball scandal. Nike shares fell after the scandal allegations, but recovered to close up 0.1%. In Europe, Britain's FTSE fell 0.4%. France's CAC 40 lost 0.1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.40%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. China's president, Xi Jinping, is in Europe today. He signed a series of agreements with France, but it's China's deal with Italy that we're going to talk about now. Over the weekend, Italy signed on to be a part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. It's a multi-year plan to ease the movement of Chinese goods around the world and likely increase China's global influence as well. Italy is the first G7 country to join, and it did so despite pressure not to from other European countries and the U.S. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what's behind the partnership.
29 deals worth roughly $3 billion. It's not huge money. But for both Italy and China, there are economics and politics at play.
First of all, there is an economic reason. Italy needs investment to boost its economy.
Giovanna Di Maio with the Brookings Institution.
Italy's growth for 2019 is foreseen to 0.2%, and it's like 1% less than the European average.
Italy's hoping for greater investment from China, that China will buy more of its exports. It may even be hoping it can call on China for help should it find itself in a debt crisis, in need of a friend to buy its bonds, says Agatha Krutz with the Rhodium Group. And the politics? Krutz says Italy's contrarian government is looking to assert its independence from Brussels.
And therefore, he's saying very loudly that if it wants to cozy up or if it wants to get closer to Beijing, then it will get closer to Beijing.
On the Chinese side, the Belt and Road Initiative creates jobs for Chinese workers and it helps facilitate Chinese trade. And the politics, Jacob Kierkegaard with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
There are those who will argue that part of the reason that they're doing this is to essentially gain political influence in the EU, and therefore there is a degree of divide and conquer in this strategy.
But Kierkegaard says these deals may not even materialize if the political party that's pushing for them loses power in Italy, and whether they'd really boost China's influence in Europe, still very TBD. I'm Tracy Samuelson, The Marketplace.
Farming has never been an easy business, and right now, American farmers are having an increasingly tough time of it. Low prices, unusually brutal weather, the record flooding still underway, and that's on top of the ongoing trade wars. All of that makes the slim profit margins for farmers even tougher to grasp, which is one of the reasons we're seeing growing delinquency rates for government farm loans. Marketplace Hub reporter Peggy Lowe from KCUR reports.
Kansas farmer Tom Giesel told us in the summer of 2017 that things weren't going so well.
Well, I'm losing money. So that means if it goes 2 years this way, then I have to work another 4 or 5 years to get back where I'm at today. So why carry on?
Nearly 2 years later, he's still carrying on. But much of the wheat and corn he was raising back then, it's still around, stored north of his small town of Larned.
The elevators are full, the terminals are full, and we got grain on the ground. So what's the prospect of price?
We drove out to see the two mountains of grain, one wheat, one corn, all raised by farmers in central Kansas and sold to the local co-op in 2017. The big piles are kept in place by concrete barriers and huge white tarps. The wheat pile alone is 660,000 bushels and may never sell. Giesel barely broke even on that crop.
It was just amazing how much wheat that I personally raised and ended up not really making hardly any money doing it. It's not because I was a bad operator. It's because the price is low.
Some grain prices have fallen roughly 50% in the last 5 years. The USDA's chief economist said recently, soybean exports alone are down 90% thanks to the U.S. trade dispute with China. And that's made it tough for some farmers to keep up with their government loans. Ernie Goss is an economist at Creighton University who conducts the monthly Rural Main Street Index. It's a survey of bank CEOs in rural areas in a 10-state region of the Midwest and West.
The farmer is definitely feeling the squeeze, and the bankers that we survey are reporting that squeeze.
The Farm Service Administration says more than a fifth of its direct loans, 21%, were delinquent in January. That's up from just 12% 8 years ago. Goss says bankers are reacting by raising collateral requirements, restructuring loans, or just rejecting the farm loans outright.
And what I expect to see is not so many foreclosures and bankruptcies. What I think we're going to see is larger farmers buying up smaller farms.
And that's been going on for decades. The latest numbers from the U.S. Agriculture Department show that the average farm is about 444 acres. Back in 1935, it was 155. As Tom Giesel and I drove out to the big mountains of grain outside Larned, Kansas, we saw fields of winter wheat just starting to come up. The wheat's planted in the fall, and right now, tiny green bristles are bursting out of the dirt. Spring planting of corn and soybeans starts in about a month.
The catch-22 that farmers are in, they have to raise a lot of volume, or they think they have to raise a lot of volume because the price is low, to cash flow.
Giesel is thinking about retiring. He got by last year by selling some land he inherited. He says lots of people are thinking about what he calls quietly exiting. So far, there are two farm auctions scheduled for this spring in Pawnee County, and Giesel says he's surprised there aren't more. In Larned, Kansas, I'm Peggy Lowe for Marketplace.
And this final note on the way out, the continuing fallout from the global grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX. Airlines have had to cancel flights because they now have fewer planes to fly. And today, American Airlines announced those cancellations will continue at least until April 24th. That's about 90 flights a day for the airline. Southwest Airlines has said the 737s handle about 5% of its daily flights and has had to cancel many of those as well. Boeing is working on a software fix for the suspected glitch that may have led to two deadly crashes. We've got to go. The Dow Industrial Average advanced 14 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ dipped 5 points, just under 0.1%. The S&P 500 shed 2 points, almost 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll have more from Kai and what he's finding in the UK, talking to regular people about Brexit. Follow along on our Instagram at MarketplaceAPM. And I'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.